Our podcast reviews well-known movies and contains spoilers. The podcast may contain mature subject matter and mature language. Listener discretion is advised. Enjoy the show.
Quiet on set. Places, everybody. And action.
All right, welcome everyone to the Hooked on Movies podcast. Today, special day today. Is this our 100th, Ken?
Yes, this is
our 100th episode. Woo-hoo! We forgot to mention that. 100 episodes. We're bringing all the stops out for this one. All the celebrities are here. And we have a special movie and a special guest. Today, we have Ted's wife, Michelle. Say hi, Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
There you go. And we are going to be reviewing her favorite movie of all time, the 1939 award-winning movie for best movie at the Oscars, Gone with the Wind. And Michelle, why don't you tell all the folks out there why we are doing Gone with the Wind?
Hooked on Movies had a little contest where you needed to guess the winners of all of the Oscars not too long ago. And I entered my submission, and I'm not exactly sure what my score was. All I know is that I was informed by Ken that I was the winner. And this is especially awesome for me because Ken and I, over several years, have debated back and forth about this movie and different aspects of it. So it's like a dream come true, coming to fruition. And I'm so honored to be here today.
Just want to let you know, I forgot to carry a one. And I'm sorry that you are not the winner.
Oh, no.
Nice try. I'm the winner. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. Here I am.
Oh, that's a shame. So we're doing
the new math that you teach.
What are we doing in its place?
Recount.
We're doing Field of Dreams.
Michelle's other favorite movie, Tin Cup.
Tin Cup.
I like Tin Cup.
Singing in the Rain. Singing in the Rain is
Singing
my.
Singing in the Rain.
Tin Cup.
Okay.
No.
All right.
Thank you.
We got time for that one. We can rock on. So let's get rolling with this one and introduce everyone. With us, as always, is Ted.
I seem to be spoiling everybody's brandy, cigars, and dreams of victory.
That's what you do every day of your life.
Yes,
it is. And I'm Eric. Why, maybe it's because I've always had a weakness for lost causes. Once they're really lost, or maybe I'm ashamed of myself. Who knows?
You should be.
I am. I'm very ashamed of myself. I'm ashamed of this impression of Rhett Butler. And Michelle.
After all, tomorrow is another day.
Ken.
Frankly, Michelle, I don't give a damn.
Wow. The anticipation on that is just palpable, man. We just, oh boy. All right. Well, let's kick this one off here. Ken, why don't you tell us about the synopsis of this movie?
What if presented as originally released in 1939 and includes themes and characters depictions which may be offensive and problematic to contemporary audiences, epic Civil War drama focuses on life pendulant to Southern belle Scarlett O'Hara, starting with her idyllic life on a sprawling plantation. The film traces her survival through the tragic history of the South during the Civil War and Reconstruction, and her tangled love affairs with Ashley Wilkes and Rhett Butler. And that's the end of the synopsis.
Unfortunately, Michelle, the truth is coming out. Ken is illiterate. He's hooked on phonics. He's hooked on phonics. So
that's how we got the name of the podcast.
On phonics.
Right. Hooked on phonics. Work for me.
Those lessons are really paying off, aren't they, Ken?
That's right. Yes. Ted, why don't you tell us the particulars of this one?
Okay. Gone with the Wind is directed by Victor Fleming with a screenplay by Sidney Howard. It's based off of the novel Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell. It has a running time of a very concise 238 minutes. It has a release date of December 15th, 1939. It had a budget of $3.85 million, non-adjusted for inflation. It had a box office gross of $390 million and adjusted for inflation, $4.5 billion. It's actually the number one highest grossing movie of all time. Rotten Tomatoes, the critics score is a certified fresh 90%. It has an audience score of 92% and it has an IMDb rating of 8.2. Gone with the Wind stars Vivian Leigh as Scarlett O'Hara, Hattie McDaniel as Mammy, Butterfly McQueen as Prissy, Leslie Howard as Ashley Wilkes, Rand Brooks as Charles Hamilton, Carol Nye as Frank Kennedy, the incomparable Clark Gable as Rhett Butler, Laura Hope Cruz as Aunt Pity Pat Hamilton, Harry Davenport as Dr. Meade, Ona Munson as Belle Watling, and Thomas Mitchell as Gerald O'Hara. And we might know, recognize Thomas Mitchell. He was in two of our other movies that we reviewed, You Can't Take It With You and It's a Wonderful Life. There's two people here that, just as an aside, they have bit parts, but they're pretty famous. George Reeves stars as Stuart Tarleton, one of the twins.
Superman.
And then Ward Bond from It's a Wonderful Life stars as Tom, the Yankee captain.
Sweet. And we were debating this last week, Ted, so just a little follow-up to our last podcast. The Nazis did invade Poland in 1939. So,
sweet.
Little sidebar there. Yes, I awesome. Know. For our listeners, they'll know what we're talking about. Ken, productions and awards. There's so many of them. We'll give you 5 minutes.
I'll need only two. As far as, you know, the role for Rhett, of course, that went to Clark Gable, who was the original choice, but they had a little trouble getting him since he was under contract with MGM. They actually offered like a 3-for-1 trade that included like Errol Flynn and Betty Davis and Olivia de Havilland.
Olivia de Havilland.
So they were really trying to make that all work, but they decided to strike a money deal and MGM could get some of the profits off of this movie. So some shrewd dealing here to get Clark Gable on board. And if they didn't get him, Gary Cooper was kind of the other person that they wanted, but he was also under contract with another company. So Clark Gable was really only the legitimate choice here. For Scarlett O'Hara, you know, they considered me for the part because I could have done it better. But only 30 actresses were actually screen test for this, including Jean Arthur, which that was a name at that particular time. I won't go through all the names because this podcast can only be so long, but Lana Turner was another one that they had considered.
Carol Lombard, too.
Diana Barrymore, which I thought that was an interesting to get a Barrymore involved in this. So, and Michelle will let us know a little bit about how this movie has changed over the years. So I won't go into that right now. As far as Academy Awards go, it did win for Best Picture in 1940, beating out what I think should have won, which is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Of course.
That's a little bit why I have a little hate for this movie. Just a little bias, just a tad little bias. And of course, Wizard of Oz was, I think, a better movie too. Academy Award for Best Actress in a Supporting Role, Hattie McDaniel. Academy Award for Best Actress in a Lead Role, Vivian Leigh. Academy Award for Best Directing, Victor Fleming. Academy Award for Best Writing, Adapted, for Sidney Howard. Academy Award for Best Cinematography, for Ray Ranahan. And then they had Academy Honorary Award. I don't even know why they would even give this out, but it was for William Menzies. I'm not sure what the Honorary Award was for.
It was for, like, technical, because it was color.
That's probably another reason why this did as well as it did.
Wasn't 1939 the first year for color movies?
No, I think there was color movies before this, but this was the biggest on its scale, I think.
Well, Wizard mm-hmm. of Oz is color, half color.
So if it went full color, it probably would have won.
Whatever.
It won the Academy Award for Best Production Design, Best Film Editing, and that's it. Those are the Academy Awards that it took home. A total of 9 Academy Awards.
I think that Hattie McDaniel winning for Best Supporting Actress is revolutionary, to say the least, in 1939 for the 1940 Academy Awards.
And that was very controversial as well, as we learned the other day, that she was not even allowed to sit at the same tables when those awards were given, which is something we'll get into.
She couldn't stay at the hotel. There was a lot of stuff. It was, definitely an era, you know, of the era then. Let's talk about the first time we saw this movie. I am intrigued with Michelle's answer on this one. So tell us the first time you saw this movie.
Thank you for asking. The first time I recall seeing this movie, I think I was probably in first or second grade. So I would say around the ages of 7 or 8 years old. It is something that my mother loved dearly. She loved this movie, and we would watch it, you know, over Christmas break or when we weren't feeling well and we were just cozy on the couch, we would put in Gone with the Wind. And then, of course, back in the day before the advent of VCRs or having to be home exactly when something was on, when it was on for like a special event or a premiere kind of a thing on television, we would watch it. So probably I would say since the young age of 7 or 8, I watched it pretty continually once or twice a year growing up. And then even as a teenager, I remember watching it. Some of my friends, I remember watching it with, even in high school. I was talking to Ted about this the other evening. I haven't watched it as frequently in the past 10 or 15 years as I did growing up. And I want to bring that back full circle at the end of it when I talk about characters that really resonate with me and the reasons why, because there's a whole little sidebar I want to do with Ken on that and nostalgia with movies. So to shorten my answer again, 7 years old, I think, was the first time that I had seen it.
So what I hear is pretty much Stockholm Syndrome, right? That's pretty much what I hear. Yes.
No. Mm-mm.
Michelle, sit down. We will be watching. Yes, that's what I hear is Stockholm Syndrome. All right. Yeah, well, if you probably haven't guessed, Michelle's going to be really leading this podcast today, and we're just going to be pawns in the game of life.
Mongo pawn in the game of life.
Yeah, I feel like Mongo when I watch this movie. Ken, when's the first time you saw it?
Oh, we were supposed to watch this movie?
Oh, that's right. So funny.
Ken, you're killing me, Smalls.
Ken watched the animated version of it.
First time I watched it was on Turner Classic Movies sometime in the 90s. I don't have an exact date. I haven't actually seen it since. So this was the first time watching it since then.
Yeah, I saw this movie, oh God, I don't know, 20 years ago. And I'll be honest with you, I don't even think I ever watched it all the way through. I would say I really just sat down and watched this thing A to Z all the way through for the first time in decades. So I'm going to go with me probably this week, really, to be honest with you, because I think 20, 25 years ago doesn't really count, because I didn't know anything about this movie except your stereotypical Franco Scar, I don't give a damn and all that stuff. What about you, Tettles? I assume you're part of the Stockholm Syndrome too?
Well, this was one of my mom's favorite movies. So when I was little, this was a movie that she just absolutely adored.
Tied to the chair, toothpicks in the eyes. I get it.
It actually is one of the reasons it sparked my interest in the Civil War. That's my area of historical expertise. There is one particular memory that I have of this movie, and that was when in the 90s they re-released it in the movie theater, and I took my mom, and that was like a big deal. I actually used the money from my paper route, and I actually took her to the movies to see Gone with the Wind. And now that she's in the condition that she's in, it's a very memorable experience for me. This is a movie that has always been there for me. I've always enjoyed this movie.
Well, Michelle, we are waiting for you to tell us the first part of the plot of this movie.
Okay, first part of the plot. In 1861, on the eve of the American Civil War, Scarlett O'Hara lives at Tara, her family's cotton plantation in Georgia, with her parents, two sisters, and their many black slaves. Scarlett is deeply attracted to Ashley Wilkes and learns he is to be married to his cousin, Melanie Hamilton. At an engagement party the next day at Ashley's home, 12 Oaks, a nearby plantation, Scarlett makes an advance on Ashley but is rebuffed. However, she catches the attention of another guest, Rhett Butler. The party is disrupted by the news of President Lincoln's call for volunteers to fight in the South, and the Southern men rush to enlist. Scarlett married Melanie's younger brother, Charles, to arouse jealousy in Ashley before he leaves to fight. Following Charles's death while serving in the Confederate States Army, Scarlett's mother sends her to the Hamilton home in Atlanta. She creates a scene by attending a charity bazaar in mourning attire and waltzing with Rhett, now a blockade runner for the Confederacy. The tide of war turns against the Confederacy after the Battle of Gettysburg. Many of the men in Scarlett's town are killed. 8 months later, as the Union Army besieges the city of Atlanta campaign, Melanie gives birth with Scarlett's aid, and Rhett helps them flee the city. Rhett chooses to go off to fight, leaving Scarlett to make her own way back to Tara. She finds Tara deserted, except for her father's, her sister, and former slaves, Mammy and Pork. Scarlett learns that her mother has just died of typhoid fever and her father has lost his mind. With Tara pillaged by Union troops and the fields unattended, Scarlett vows to ensure her and her family's survival.
And that's the end of the movie.
And that's the end of the movie, everybody. I never got that. So Pork is the other slave's name?
Yeah, Pork.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I never got that. Okay.
Can I start by saying a few things?
Oh, please.
Okay. I just want to start by saying that, yes, this is one of my favorite and beloved movies of all time. However, it does portray a romanticized and idyllic version of the South. I just want to state for all of our listeners that it denies the horrors of slavery and the racial inequality. It's a classic film with a specific perspective on history. And of course, I would be remiss if I didn't put on my educator hat. So if you'll give me a moment and grin and bear it. For the case of teaching history and education and perspective taking, being an educator for about 25 years now, I think it's important to say teaching history shows how the past affects the future. And when a nation is divided or feels divided, studying history can serve like as a guide for us as to what has happened from multiple perspectives. And now, learning and seeing those perspectives, we can take the best course of action moving ahead. So when I think about like why I teach history in my own classroom, or I weave in different aspects of war, I'm actually teaching conflict right now. That's my unit. I'm teaching my students. What's the goal of it? I think like we need children and people to be informed citizens. You could also make the argument that teaching history is like analytical research or factual information. You want to develop those critical thinking skills. Like there is not one perfect story. So with that being said, it's important to hear all stories and voices. And I'd like to mention that I am curious in learning more about something like 1619 Project, which is an ongoing initiative from the New York Times Magazine. It began, I think, in August 2019, and it marks the 400th anniversary of the beginning of the American slavery and aims to reframe the country's history by placing the consequences of slavery and contributions of Black Americans at the center of that national narrative and learning about their oppression, the struggle, and the resistance. With all that being said, I think that it's so important to keep in mind that we're learning about different people's perspective. And when I teach perspective, I joke around with the students. I say, okay, let's put our red glasses on, these pretend glasses, this gif I have of this woman. I think it was actually from like American Bandstand. And I found she put the red glasses and then the show would start. When we talk about perspective taking, we think about teaching how it expands your thinking. It helps you develop empathy. I always preach at the dinner table each night. You can ask my daughter, you can ask Ted. All the world's problems could be solved with communication and empathy. So I'm a big one about perspective taking. It increases inclusion and equity. It reduces bias. And then ultimately, it helps you be creative and solve more problems. When we're thinking about this and going back, I think it's important, and we'd be remiss not to mention Margaret Mitchell being the author of the novel Gone with the Wind. When I was doing a little research myself on Margaret Mitchell and writing this book, which, by the way, multiple screenwriters adapted her book into this movie, we need to remember that she was born on November 8th in 1900, and American Civil War had just ended 35 years before she was born, and she grew up in Atlanta, and she was surrounded by storytellers who recounted her with, you know, their firsthand narratives and experiences during the Civil War. She began writing the book from that Southern point of view during that Civil War construction time, set in her hometown of Georgia. And I think that's important before we start in the movie that we understand that it's her perspective. It's not necessarily the right perspective. There's many other perspectives out there. Like I said, I have curiosity about 1619 Project, which I'm starting to look into more and learn more about myself, but it is a perspective in history that really does not give credit to and denies the specific perspective of history of the atrocities of slavery. And I just wanted to put that out there before we continue reviewing this.
Yeah, I would have gone with that. Scarlett is hot. That's how I would have started off this
podcast. Yeah, so I mean,
I guess it's better that we went with an educational view of it first before I said anything.
We always debate this when we watch movies, like when we did Argo, you know, how the script took a lot of liberties. If that's the term we like to use, is liberties, mm-hmm. As versus fact and fiction.
That's a good verb. I like that verb.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And my argument is if you're getting your history from a movie, you got to screw loose. if you're believing everything that you see and hear from a movie and you're taking that verbatim as a history report, holy cow, you got some issues. I agree with you 100% on what you said. It's a very interesting topic. You know, I know Ted is a big aficionado of Civil War history, so I would anticipate, just based on the movie itself, yeah, the slaves are definitely treated extremely well, and there is no way they were, even with the editing of the movie down the road, there is no way that they were, I guess romanticized is a good word, as you would say.
Yeah, that's a good
word. So, all right. Yes. We've never had a PSA on our podcast before.
I completely concur with what Eric says. If you're delusional enough to actually believe that Gone with the Wind is a historical novel, then you're irredeemable at that point. There's nothing that anybody's going to be able to say to bring you to reality. This is not Ken Burns's The Civil War. This is a novelization. It is one person's perspective. It's a highly one-sided view and romanticized view of what pre-Civil War South was.
You can relate this, Ted, to today's history with the Vietnam War.
Of course.
Because we're only literally 50 years, 49 years outside of Vietnam, the end of Vietnam War in 75. So when you have people that are born just after that and they're speaking with, you know, veterans that are still alive from the Vietnam War, you are getting a very one-sided approach. Right. And as we know, especially from what I learned in history in the early 90s, late 80s in high school, completely different than the narrative now that you get about the Vietnam War. You make a very good point about her being born in 1900, 35 years after. She is getting the narrative of Confederate soldiers, and it's going to be very biased, obviously. But
to them, it's going to be the truth, though. So the
folklore is the truth.
Yeah, from their perspective, and this is how the whole movie plays out, is how they look at being treated. We've looked at other movies where on the flip side is how a person is treated compared to somebody else. I mean, this is a bad example, but if you look at like Cobra Kai, Johnny's the bad guy during the Karate Kid movies, right? But then when you get to the TV series, it flips it and it shows his side of the story and how he looked at everything, which is completely different how we looked at things. So it all comes down to perspective, right?
And Ken, I don't think that's a bad comparison at all. I love that comparison that you just gave, because I think that just hammers home the point that it needs to be about perspective. And when you look at someone else's perspective anywhere in history, we have to realize there's not one perfect story. And I think it's really interesting, Eric, how you had said, I learned about the Vietnam War when I was in, you know, history classes in school, and now it's different now. And that's important to know too, because a lot of history is biased, or it is given to you by a specific perspective. So I think just seeing that other viewpoint is so incredibly important. No, I love that comparison.
And a lot of people will reject that because they like what they learned when they're younger, what they grew up on. So nostalgia. Anything that's new,
it's more easily digestible.
Well, it's easy to be digestible because of when it was presented to that person. If you learn about your history in grade school, middle school, high school, or something like that, but then you learn more in your 30s and 40s, you're set in your ways. You grew up with this being factual.
The best example is Thanksgiving.
Oh, of course.
How we grew up, how Thanksgiving was, the Indians helped the white men when they settled and gave them their first Thanksgiving. We all know that's not how it went down.
Right.
No way.
Columbus, too.
Yeah, Christopher Columbus, too. I mean, yes.
That's a whole different podcast.
Everything is romanticized.
Charlie Brown's Thanksgiving.
Don't even get me started. Yes.
There is one vocabulary word that I am going to probably come up multiple times, and that's the lost cause narrative. This is where history differs. During the middle of Reconstruction, in an effort to justify the tremendous loss of life and the loss of wealth in the South, this narrative came forward about the justification for the Civil War from the South's perspective. For a lot of people, that became the truth because they cloaked that in actual fact. And a lot of what we're going to talk about here, especially as far as the slavery and everything like that, is cloaked in the lost cause narrative. I'm not going to say it was insidious, because I truly believe they were subjected after the Civil War and after Lincoln was killed. the North treated the South horribly.
Yeah, they were pretty much almost like a territory.
The Northern states wanted a pound of flesh.
Sure.
So this narrative popped up. The other thing that I'm going to say is the modern narrative here. We have two sections of people, and Ken mentioned one section, the people who want to deny the fact that there were horrors and atrocities in slavery. But then on the other side of the coin, we have another section of people who want to censor or eliminate things that they deem are not accurate or quote unquote offensive. This is where I have my problem. These two sections of people.
Are we talking about Disney?
Well, we'll get to Disney because these two sections of people have massive bullhorns and they get all of the oxygen in the room. And the fact of the matter is tearing down statues, eliminating Gone with the Wind from HBO Max, or as you mentioned, Eric, Disney, not allowing Song of the South to be put on to Disney Plus. I'm sorry, I'm free white and 21. If you're free in whatever color 21, you should have the ability and the bandwidth enough to decide what you want to watch. I vehemently disagree with both sides of this. I don't believe that this movie should be edited in any way because it's a time capsule. This was made in a specific time by a specific director with a specific screenwriter by a specific movie company.
It was a team of screenwriters who adapted her book. I think I need to reel you back in here, Ted. I agree with what you're saying. With all that being said, we need to remember again, this is from Scarlett's perspective. It is from that Southern point of view during that Civil War reconstruction. And it's about how her life of privilege was destroyed by the conflict of war and demolished, and how she is a survivor. We might not like her character, but she is a badass and she's a survivor, and how how her world was turned upside down by it. With that being said, we're acknowledging that it's not all factual. It doesn't tell the whole story. However, I do have to play a little bit of devil's advocate here with going back to just saying vehemently, oh, if you were getting your history from this, you were wrong. Well, I'm going to tell you from a child's point of view, when I was younger, I wasn't even focused on that slavery part of it. I was more shocked about the Civil War. It got me intrigued from it. That iconic moment when she stands back and she runs down there and she's like, Dr. Meehan, you have to help me deliver this baby. He's like, I don't have any chloroform. I don't have any bandages. I've got all these men dying around me. There's nothing to bring in a child in this world. Just go do it. And she stands back and they pan back and you see all of the men laying there bleeding and dying. I vividly remember that as a child. It's giving me goosebumps right now. It actually intrigued me and made me more curious to want to learn about the Civil War. I remember asking my parents questions about the Civil War, wanting to learn more about it. It kind of like ignited this curiosity in me, which I think is a mark of an excellent piece of media, whether it be a book, a film, anything. If it ignites curiosity in you, you're seeing it from a specific perspective. You want to know more. That's going to help become part of your story in your mind and create that curiosity where you want to seek out more knowledge about it. So I do feel like part of it was some of my first training on history. It might have not been 100% accurate. And again, I'm agreeing with what you're saying about the horrors of slavery, the atrocity, whitewashing it, only showing that, what was the verbiage you said again, Ted? I forgot the exact words you used, but it helped me learn more about a perspective of the Civil War and made me curious is what I'm guessing.
Sure. I mean, in this case, yes. I mean, you get a taste for it, but you, Michelle, obviously did not get your history from it. It gave you a taste of it. You wanted to learn more about it. But I mean, honestly, I think we really need to kind of discuss the movie in general. Yes. When we're talking about whether or not you agree with the politics or the way it was brought to you, let's focus in.
I just want to say that I was shocked. Ashley wanted to marry his cousin. That's what really shocked me out of all these things here.
1861. The money in the family.
The Brits are doing it all the time. Come on.
You got to think about the history of it, you know. Yeah. And the Wilkes has always married their cousins. And it was to keep the money in the family.
That's exactly.
I know that was a little disturbing. I'm like, but I knew.
I knew the era.
Yes,
that's why Charles was promised to India, and she had a hatred for Scarlett too,
right?
Because she just married Charles to make Ashley jealous.
I just love the fact that all the guys love Scarlett. I mean, they're just lining up. All she has to do is just stick on her tush, and all of a sudden they're like, "Oh, Miss Scarlett."
Little bit of a whore. Little tiny. Just
a little. Oh, I don't think she's actually having sex. She's a flirt. A massive flirt.
She's a massive flirt.
Yes, she knows what she's doing.
She's a survivor. She loves fiercely. She has perseverance, and she's a badass, and I'll defend her.
She is. She really goes from being that, like, prissy, I want everything done for me, to my world is falling apart, and then she rebuilds an empire.
And becomes that prissy woman again.
But, you know, rebuilds an empire, you know, of lumber.
She's raped. She kills a man. She loses both of her parents. She loses her daughter. She almost starves to death with her family. She marries her sister's beloved. She's widowed several times. She's rejected. She relentlessly seeks a man who does not love her. And yet she survives. And that's what makes her character so outstanding. We don't have to necessarily connect with her in every other way, but the fact that she is surviving all of this and this life of opulence, and then this conflict happens, and literally overnight this loss of privilege comes in and her life is turned upside down, and she literally does whatever it takes to survive, and she's a fierce badass, and I love her for it.
And the great thing, it doesn't have a happy ending.
No, she does not end up with red at the end.
She does not get what she wants. She finally gets her shit together and decides, yes, Rhett, you're the one I love. But I know I'm jumping ahead. But one of the things I really liked about this movie is it didn't have that stereotypical lovey-dovey happy ending that we get in a lot of movies today, where you can almost write the plot from A to Z because you know how it's going to end in a rom-com. So let's get into this one. Let's talk about the early start of the plot here, where she is going to the ball.
The barbecue at Twelve Oaks, where the engagement's going to be announced.
Everybody's war happy.
I was able, this last time watching it for the podcast, I was able to figure out exactly what time we're talking about here. We're looking at the period of time right after Beauregard fired on Fort Sumter. So war is sweeping the South. Secession is sweeping through the South. It's kind of nebulous as to whether or not Georgia has seceded yet, but I believe while they're at the barbecue is when they find out that Georgia has seceded from the Union. So they're off to fight.
Michelle, clarify for me. Was Rhett kicked out of the army? Was he not able to get in West Point, which is still not received by his family,
any decent family in Charleston, which I mean, we can assume that they're not, because of his being kicked out of West Point, because he is a blockade runner, because of all of the things that he's doing, the family isn't going to say, yeah, you can come stay with us in Charleston.
So it's like a blockade runner. Is he doing like just a bunch of illegal shady shit?
No, here's the thing. I think I pinpointed exactly why he's not received by his family and kicked out of West Point is because, do you remember, towards the end of the movie, Belle talks about her having a son in New Orleans. It's widely believed, and I believe it's in the novelization, that it is highly suggested that is Rhett's son and Belle's son. And that's why he's not received by his family in Charleston.
Michelle, have you read the book?
No, I have not. And see, this was so funny that you should ask that. First of all, I'm such a fan that I'm like, why haven't I read the book? I actually have it on a shelf in a room over there. I've never read it. And I told Ted, I said, you know, I'd really like to pause this for a while. I would love to record it down the road because I feel like I need to actually read the book to give such a true fan's perspective on it. But unfortunately, no, I have not. But I've, you know, researched a little bit.
Why don't we pause it and wait till 2030? In a couple weeks. You're so funny.
Well,
it's only 48 hours on Audible.
Ted, can you explain to us and to the audience what blockade running is so we know a little bit better?
When the Civil War started, it was called the Anaconda. that was what it was nicknamed by Lincoln and his war cabinet. What they did was essentially U.S. Navy completely blocked all ports going
all
in and out of the
ports.
Town.
Okay.
So, yeah. So the first main targets were Charleston, Fort Sumter.
Because the South is trading all of their cotton with Europe.
Exactly. There was two cannon factories in the entire South when the war broke out. One was in Alabama and one was in Georgia. There was only one place in the South that was actually making warships, and that was Mobile in Alabama. So what they did was they cut off the South. New Orleans was the first city to fall in the Civil War. The North took over New Orleans immediately, and that crippled not only the western half of the Confederacy, but it crippled the rest of the Confederacy as well. Now, granted, Charleston remained open, but 200 miles out to sea, there's a massive blockade of warships preventing British and French and other European nations from getting supplies in. Savannah was another huge port that was cut off. And Florida at the time really didn't have any major ports. Not that what we would consider major ports, like Miami wasn't a
Jacksonville.
Really a thing.
Jacksonville's exactly. Up close to the border, but no, I get it.
Right.
I get it.
That's what we're talking about.
So what is Rhett's thing
what
here?
Rhett does is he's a pirate, essentially. He got himself a fast ship, and he has figured out how to maneuver around through the blockade. And so what he does is he goes back and forth to Europe to get supplies.
That's true, because he's going back and forth to London.
Because he said all of his money is in Liverpool. And that makes complete sense, because I bet he hitched another ship to his ship, because Liverpool is England's biggest shipbuilder. And I'm sure he had contacts in Ireland as well, at Belfast.
So Red is not very well liked amongst the elites in
Georgia. But they rely on him. The South is relying on people like him. In some parts of the South, that's the only way they were getting good food.
So that makes sense why in that meeting, when he was like, oh, we're going to lose, we're going to get our ass kicked, technically they should have just went out and just beat the hell out of him, but they didn't.
Well, they know
it's
true.
Figureheads prevailed.
And see, and that's one of the things, too. They're all full of this gallantry and, you know, this chivalry.
Chivalry fighting, yes.
Exactly. The whole thing, I'm going to slap you with
my
leather glove, and we're going to duel. That's what we're talking about. Because you hear them say, and this was a true sentiment, they thought that the Civil War was only going to last 3 weeks.
Right.
And the whole sentiment that one Southern gentleman is worth 20 Yankee soldiers. Well, it's just not true, because, well, the Industrial Revolution started to make the grinds of war into a horror show. He knows the landscape, but he profits from it. And that's what pisses people off in the South more than anything, is the fact that he's profiting off of their suffering. It's no different than any other war profiteer, whether it be Lockheed Martin or name a missile creator or helicopter maker.
Tony Stark.
And, well, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, he's a profiteer. Tony Stark was a profiteer. So yeah, that's why they're pissed at him. Down deep, they all know that they're all farmers.
I didn't understand the hatred towards
Belle Watley, some madam of ill repute. She runs the whorehouse. Yeah, so they don't want to touch her money. It's dirty money. Even when Prissy goes over to bring the carriage, oh, my mom will wear me out with a peach strap if she knew I went up to Belle Watley's. You know, that's the house of ill repute. It's inappropriate to associate with Belle and any women of the night and their money. It goes back again to kind of what we've been saying about that pride and that ego, the romanticized version of the South, the elitist kind of attitude. You know, we see that she's discriminated against too, Belle Watley, even though she has a good heart when she pleads her case to Melanie.
Yeah, she's also rich too. Michelle talked about Scarlett and how awesome Scarlett is, and I'm not going to dispute how awesome Scarlett is.
I will dispute it.
I know you will, so I'll leave that to you.
She's the Black Widow.
The worst character I can't stand is Ashley. Ashley drives me insane. He is so milquetoast. He's dumb. The only reason he gets to lead a cavalry unit is because he's rich. And that's another thing that happened during the Civil War as well. But let's be perfectly honest. He's so dumb.
How dumb is he?
He would have done something dumb in battle and gotten himself killed. And a lot of his men killed.
I don't think he's that bad of a... Isn't he the one that says something, don't want war? Isn't he the first one that kind of...
That's the last smart thing he says in the entire movie.
See, I'm going to disagree. I don't think he's a bad character at all. I think he's a character that's caught in two places. And as Michelle kind of talked about it earlier, about the money situation and what family has to do, you know, he's marrying into the money. And that's what he's probably required to do. But he does have a heart for Scarlett, even though Scarlett really doesn't have a heart
for him.
He's
completely dominated by Scarlett.
Well, that is where maybe the passion comes in when we think about this triangle here. Could he really handle somebody like her? How could I help but loving you? You have all the zest and the passion for life. And I'm not quoting this exactly, but he says something like, you have all the passion for life that I don't have. So in other words, I'm a Wilkes. This is our money. We marry our cousins. This is my path in life. I've got this calm, cool demeanor, but she is this fiery, fierce spirit who is, you know, constantly chasing after him.
I actually think he does a good job of pushing back off of it. I mean, he's
really
he's kind of, I do.
Yeah, I think he does a very good job of that.
He does a really good job.
He could have easily had an affair with her. So easy.
That's Rhett's major criticism of him. He can't mentally stay faithful, but his body won't let him.
Actually, that's true. It's the other way around.
She's always mentioning him, and it's always being brought up in conversation with other people.
But it's also the pressure that Scarlett puts on him consistently. It's not like he goes check Scarlett out. It's not like he shows up, you know, at Scarlett's place to tell her that he loves her. It's always Scarlett going towards him. If I had an attractive woman coming to my house every time my wife wasn't around, what kind of pressure would that put on me and put on with any guy?
I can arrange that if you
don't.
We can talk off air.
If he had any sort of backbone, he would distinctly tell her that it's never going to happen.
He does at the beginning. You know, that's where Brett pops up. Oh, yeah. You know, all of a sudden we see him. He's heard the whole conversation. She's mad because he rejected her. So he does do that multiple times. He rejects her. But each time he rejects her, it's a little bit less and a little bit less and a little bit less. Because
she gets a little stronger and stronger.
Well, do you think he likes it?
I think any man would like it, though.
He says, I can't fight you both, when she puts on the little act. Oh, Ashley's so horrible. He won't help me run my lumber business. And, you know, Melanie turning around. When I think of Scarlett working out in the fields, picking cotton so we didn't starve, how dare you? And he's like, I can't fight you both. I'm done. So he's good out on the battlefield, but he's not going to fight them both. And maybe there's part of him that he's just resigned himself to that, or he enjoys it.
I think it's a little bit of both. I think he doesn't want it, but at the same time, when it happens, especially as the years go on and you are in a marriage, you kind of wonder to yourself, am I still wanted? And here's a woman who still wants him outside of his marriage. I mean, he does have the perfect wife, right? I mean, she's like the sweetest lady.
Oh yeah, Rhett loves her. Rhett's like, she's the only one who gives me any respect.
Melanie is the greatest character in this,
in my
opinion.
But see, Scarlett's the yin to Ashley's yang. And he says, you have all the passion and the fire that I lack. So he's very aware of his milquetoastness. If we can even say that's an adjective we can use for this. And he admires that passion in her, just like Melanie does. She loves her for that. She says, oh, you're so vivacious. And India's like, how can you say that? You see how she threw herself at your brother Charles. And she's like, India, she's so vivacious and full of life. The men naturally flock to her. And they're all like, Melanie, you're too good. Stop. You know, you're killing us, girl. They both see that in her. And they both admire that in their own way. And I think this kind of, we just need to bring it back to full circle again. Eric, you had said earlier in the podcast, it's not typical. It doesn't end on a happy note. She has to struggle, and she has to struggle and struggle and struggle and strategize. And I think that's why.
And
to
at the end, she doesn't get any man.
She doesn't get anything, but it's left open. That's my favorite line is, after all, tomorrow is another day, and you can all sit there and chuckle at me, but it's teaching us a life lesson. She is the face of perseverance. And that is what's so attractive about her. She is taking these lessons in, whether we like her character or her persona or not, whether we can justify her spoiled bratness and herself throwing herself at a man when she could have anybody she wanted, but she continues to strategize. She takes those lessons in.
But she uses she the man. She,
well, of course not, she does.
Earlier, you said that the man doesn't love her. We feel like they at least love her or have a fascination with her, you know, maybe an unhealthy one. But I'm going to argue here that Melanie is actually a stronger character, that she's the strongest character out of everyone here because, you know, she has to deal with the fact that she is a, you know, physically weak person. I love the fact that when Scarlett does shoot that Yankee that comes into her house that, you know, that she's the there with the sword. She's there with the sword and she's happy that she did it. But then later on, when we see them, when they come to the house and they're all pretending they don't know that the men are at, get the guys.
At the clan meeting?
Yeah.
But she handles the situation. When Scarlett and Ashley get kind of caught in a little bit of an embrace there, she handles the situation with grace. She always handles everything the right way. So you could actually say she's the strongest character in this whole movie. If there's a person to emulate, would be her and not Scarlett. Scarlett uses and abuses and doesn't care who she hurts on the way as long as she gets what she wants.
Okay. So from a moral perspective, like if I'm looking at it through my Ken glasses and okay, who do I want to walk away morally from this movie? What can I take from Melanie's character? Absolutely. However, I'm going to be completely vulnerable and transparent here. And I was going to give you a super hard time, Ken. I was going to come at it and say as a listener of your podcast that I noticed that many times your movies, one of the tens of people who listen to the podcast on a regular basis, many times you come at a movie from the perspective of nostalgia or character connection. And like, I feel so many times like you want that personal connection with a character or you have that nostalgia from a specific or particular time of your life. And that's why you might favor a character more or you might favor a movie more. But I would be a hypocrite by saying that that's not the same thing for me with Gone with the Wind, because it is obviously very nostalgic for me. And it's a movie I've seen at least 25 times and was a staple in my childhood. I do have a character connection. And I'm not saying that I'm, you know, saying that Scarlett O'Hara should be put up on this pedestal. I do see the morality and the caring and the loving and a character of Melanie as well. And I'm not denying that at all. I'm just saying that it's okay to come at a movie and say, you know what, I like this character's perspective. I like this character. I don't like this character. I like this one for this. But to say the movie is trash because the main character is, you know, never acting in a certain way. Okay.
Never said it was trash. I said it's overrated. It's just the fact that you have a character who you're building. And I like her build up. I really do. For the first third of the movie, up until having to rebuild the plantation, I'm liking her character. I really am. When things start going her way, she reverts back to the character that she was in the beginning. And I know I'm getting ahead of ourselves here. What if she does at the end of the movie, Brett allows her to come back and she's comfortable for a little bit? She's just going to want something else later. There's never any ever satisfying her in the long run. For me, she's that girlfriend that I would say that I had a lot of fun with, but not somebody that I would want to be by my side when all the chips were down.
And I appreciate your point of view with that. I'm just saying that we can learn a lot of lessons in survival. And I think, you know, when we think about just the psychology of different characters and connection with different characters in movies or thinking of their perspectives or where they are coming from, there might be a little bit of Scarlett in all of us. And maybe as a man, you're saying no.
but
the ability to just do whatever you can to survive. Maybe, and you know, she says, if I have to lie, if I have to steal, if I have to cheat, I will never be hungry again. And by God, she makes that come true. She marries her sister's betrothed. She's widowed how many times? I mean, she cheats and lies and puts on all these false ears to survive. I think that's the cinematic enjoyment of this character. You know what I mean? Of seeing her passion. Just like in the way the character of Melanie is portrayed, how Olivia de Havilland does that. The way she looks at Rhett when they're on that raid and she just looks in his eyes and they're communicating without saying anything and you just just feel the strength and the goodness from Melanie's character. She has such a depth to her character as well that we can pull important things out of too. I think in all the characters, we can do this. And that's why, okay, you didn't say it was trash, but I think that's why the movie is so phenomenal, because we see a little bit of ourselves in each of these people, or we see the human condition. If you can't connect personally to a Scarlett O'Hara or a Belle Watley or an Ashley Wilkes, we've had conflict. We've done things we might not have appreciated in ourselves to survive. And what have we done to make sure that it's happened, even though it might be wrong? And we know in the human condition that that might be a negative thing or something we're not very proud of, but by God, we survived, or we made it, or we persevered. And maybe we see a little bit of ourselves in that. And maybe that's why this movie has stood the test of time, barring again, it not showing the atrocities of what slavery is really like in the history. But we're seeing that little bit of ourselves and maybe that negative bit of ourselves in some of the characters.
I mean, I understand what you're saying to a certain extent, but I just don't think Scarlett is a likable character at all. I understand that you like
some of her qualities.
Her qualities, but she is not a good person. She does things for herself and only for herself. Even up to the end, she's selfish and it's all about her. And I have a problem with the character like that.
I disagree. I disagree with you. Okay, so think back to when, before everything happened, and her father says to her, Katie Scarlett, don't say that about Tara. It's the only thing that lasts. The land is the only thing that lasts. And he's kind of just saying to his daughter, this is your legacy. This is your home. This is where you're from. And again, I'm going to go back to Margaret Mitchell, and shame on me. Again, strike against me in my column for not having fully read the book to call upon, but knowing about where she came from in her perspective in her native Georgia when she wrote this book. And she had heard all the stories firsthand from everybody she grew up with about the Civil War Reconstruction, okay? And them telling her this over and over. It's almost like a heritage part of it, you know, like a piece of you inside of you. So even though she did some things that were selfish and she's still chasing after Ashley, and we might be scratching her head, why? And look at Rhett has turned himself around and he enlisted and, you know, he saw the passion in her and fell in love with her, but she's still doing all these devious things. Does she really 100% for herself? Or, you know, she might have been striving for things that she wanted, but in the same sense, she'd allowed them to keep Tara, to not allow everyone to starve when her sisters had typhoid and she came home and her mother died. And Melanie was too weak to do what she needed to do. And Ashley was out fighting the war. She did enable everybody to survive. So I think that it goes back to her home, her family, her heritage, her lineage. And that was what was important. So I argue that she isn't all selfish. Yes, it comes off as that. And, you know, you're thinking back to her privileged lifestyle and gathering all the hearts at the barbecue and not wanting to talk about the war and wanting everybody doting on her and being the belle of the ball and making a spectacle. But is she really all for herself, or is she working for everybody as well?
No, I think she's pretty vain. I mean, the one part that I think about is when she's trying to get back into her dress after the pregnancy and she wants to get into an 18 and a half. Because all she cares about is how she looks in front of other people. Her first husband dies. We understand that she never loved him, but she never really gave him any respect at all. And she did the same thing with the second husband. The second husband dies trying to avenge her. Because she was attacked.
That's one way to put it.
But he wants to do something about what had happened to her. And he gets killed. And she feels a little guilty. But as soon as Brett is there to like offer himself up there, she's ready to take it on. Because she's tired of doing all the things she needs to do to get herself wealthy again. This is the easiest way. She even tells Brett, well, yeah, partly it's because of the money. She's always looking for ways for her life to be better. She doesn't care who she steps on. On the way, she steps on Brett multiple times on the way, and she steps on her sisters, and she steps on gentlemen that, you know, want to court her and want to be with her. She takes advantage of every situation for her benefit. Do some people get the benefit from it? Yes, but there's a reason why nobody likes her. I mean, they're walking down the street and everybody's saying hi to them, and he's the only one saying hi back.
Yeah, they're always like, hi, Brett.
She's a snob.
I'm a Scarlet.
Yeah, she doesn't care about how everybody's affected. And I'm sorry, I'm like Brett at the end of the movie. You know, right. The last 5 minutes of the movie is not going to, you know, you're not going to all of a sudden say, sorry, I now understand how I feel about everybody, and I'm supposed to take that. I'm happy Brett left because, you know what? She deserved it. So, okay. I mean, Rhett does everything for her and, you know, gives her multiple chances, and she steps all over them. She's very prideful.
She is.
You know, do I feel bad for her? Yes, especially with a daughter dying. But she's just not a very likable person. And if your movie centers around her, which it does, because she's in practically every scene in this movie. Clark Gable is not in this as much as people probably think he is. She is by far the lead. And so if your story is about this person, I think your person should have more redeeming qualities a little quicker than the last 5 minutes of the movie.
But can I ask you, when we're talking about conflict and war, what about those people who survived by doing things selfishly or by cutting corners or being manipulative, being strategic?
She was doing it's this true. Before the war. She married because that guy out of hatred towards Ashley, wanted to show Ashley up. So we could say all we want about the war doing this to her, but she was the same manipulative, all in it for herself person before the war even started.
And don't we all have that in us? In ourselves, isn't there a dark and a light side? Is there not a Melanie and a Scarlet in all of us?
There is, but I like to think it's more 80-20 Melanie and 20% Scarlet, and not
that,
the other
and
way
that
around.
Could be, yes, and it depends on the situation that we're in. I'm just saying, we can't discount this movie not being epic and groundbreaking.
Scarlet, let's think about the time, too. Not Melanie. Simple as that.
Let's think about the novel, the timing of the movie and the novel as well. So was it right for women or anybody to act like that and to show that dark side, that shadow side of yourself that wants everything, that is manipulative? Okay,
I would hate a male that did this. If I watched a movie with a male that did the same thing, I would have the same problems that I have with the females. I love this movie for the fact that it was one of the greatest roles for a woman. It still is one of the greatest roles ever for a woman. However, I just feel like her character was just so unlikable. If there's a comparable guy, which I'm sure there is in other movies that does those things, I'm not going to say I love this character. I love this guy because he manipulates females. If you watched a movie about a guy who took advantage of a woman to get a benefit out of it, you know, money, fame, whatever, you wouldn't like that character either.
Why does your enjoyment of a movie have to be so wrapped up in your connection with a character?
Because that's the kind of person I am. I'm all about the character development.
That's the way that you view the movie. Yeah, okay.
That's how I view the movie. It's all based on character and how they're developed. And I liked how, like I said earlier, I liked how she was being developed. I thought she was turning corners, and then they took a different route, and then they try to like clean it all up in 5 minutes towards the end of the movie. For me, that doesn't work. If you took a little bit more time to clean it up at the end of the movie, then maybe I could accept her a little bit more. But her just saying sorry, like at the end of the movie, like she does, you know, to Rhett, I agree with him for not giving her a chance at that time, because you know what? Not enough time to prove herself has happened. If there's 10 or 15 more minutes of this movie where I see her earnestly trying to get him back and doing it in a way that's honorable, then I might have a different opinion on her. To try to bring her character back up in 5 minutes at the end of a movie because somebody just died is just not enough
well,
for me.
And I'm not saying we should, you know, say she's the perfect role model for everybody. I'm just saying that when I think of her character in this movie, I think about perseverance at no matter what the cost and survival. But to me, from a psychological point of view and like looking at humanity in ourselves, that, you know, we might have that part of us that still feels that way. We might not act on it, but we might have feelings like that where we want to manipulate or we want to be that spoiled child or we want the things we want and we're going to do whatever we want to get there. And that's why going back to the relationship with Ashley and Scarlett, I think is important here too. And he says, you know, I'm not that kind of man. That's what I lack, that passion, that fire in you. I'm not that person that you are there. You have all of that. And that is what I am missing. And I think that's why he has this lingering whatever it is with her, you know, on and on. Now, I just think that it's a brilliant movie. And I think the depth of the characters, it holds the test of time. And it makes us think about the human condition, and, you know, when we dig deeper into it.
We've been talking Scarlett all the time, but let's yes. talk about Rhett a little bit more, because I don't think he's the perfect character either. There's a lot of things I do like about Rhett. I think he's kind of a realist. He really understands what's really happening here. He knows what kind of person Scarlett is. Nobody else seems to know. The other women seem to know. All the other men don't seem to know how Scarlett is, but Rhett does know how she is. But he's also somebody that's also a manipulator.
Of course he is.
Yeah. He's a scoundrel. There's a lot of things that I don't agree with that he does. But one thing that he's consistent throughout the movie is his love for her, his profound love for her. He goes great lengths and even tells her, from day one, when I first met you, I was in love with you. And the way that he goes about sharing that, I enjoy that portion of his character, the way he tries to take care of her, but at the same time, teach her lessons. Like, he doesn't automatically give her money when she needs it. You know, she's trying to manipulate him about coming to see him while he's in jail and things of that nature. But he kind of knows what she's doing. He gets her. It's kind of almost sad by the time we get to the end that he's given up to a certain extent. I do love that portion of his personality. Some of the other things I'm not, like I said, a big fan of. I still question him leaving her with Melanie and the help
and the baby.
And he goes back to the army. At least you could have done that after you got them safely home. I never understood the reason for him abandoning them. Because that happens more than once throughout the whole movie, not just with Rhett, but with other situations that I just don't get. It just doesn't make any sense. And that's why this movie for me is just...
I personally think it's because he knows she'll make it. She has the tenacity and the determination of 10,000 people, and he's not worried about it. So he says, I'm going to be for the only cause that I've known, and that cause is Rhett Butler. And that's why he loves her, because he sees that manipulative, greedy side of himself reflected in her in female form. And he sees that mirror, and it's so attractive to him, and he can't resist it. And he knows she'll survive. So he needs to do what he needs to do to save his reputation and join in and fight. Yes, it was a little shocking too. You know, the fire is still burning in the background. Atlanta's on fire. You know, oh, I got to go and join. Yeah, like you're kind of surprised with that. But I think, again, that would get into the intricacies of the adaptation of the book versus the screenwriters who adapted it. Because that was one of the first things that Ted and I discussed when we talked about this, like, oh, who adapted it? Who wrote the screenplay? I did a little research on that. And just so you know, too, the book is written from that third person omnipresent, like omniscient point of view, like an outsider looking it in. So it isn't written from Scarlett's point of view.
I agree what you just said about his faith in her to get home. But it's not just her. You have a sick woman and a newborn baby, and it's a little bit more than just her. If it was just her trying to get back home, then I would understand that. But there's more at stake. And if something goes really wrong with Melanie, you know, or with the baby, it's better to have two people there that can pull through than just one. So that's where my biggest problem is. It's not by just leaving her by herself. It's leaving her with a situation by herself.
Again, I think they're just kind of reinforcing that he is just like her. He's selfish
wrong.
Too. He's thinking of himself, even though he's going to join the cause now. He's just as thinking of himself as her. And she's like, wait a minute. You know, I've got this newborn. Melanie's passed out. Prissy's here. Nope. Peace out. I'm going to go join them.
That's why he's not a perfect character. That's why I don't like him completely, because I do feel like I don't care how much faith he has in her. There's more than just her at stake.
Isn't he the only truth teller, though?
He's
the only person in the entire movie that tells the truth 100% of the time.
That and the
Melanie. She does a white lie. She's like, oh, you don't be scaredy cats. Your sister was cleaning the pistol and nearly shot herself. Oh, tell KT Scarlett to be more careful when she shoots the stray.
Belle is the person that I'm thinking of, right? Yeah, she's a straight shooter. And Rhett actually says that about her at the end. Is one thing you are is always telling the truth, telling it like it is. Yeah, so both of those characters are so similar. Probably why they never got really together, because they are probably very similar in those type of ways.
Well, and as far as the first half of this movie, there are a few scenes that are indelible and are a piece of cinematic history. Probably the greatest is the pullback on the train depot showing all of the wounded soldiers. That brings the whole war home in itself. And I think that it's a wonderful picture, and it really shows the heartache of what not only Atlanta is going through, but the rest of the South as well, and the North for that matter. The burning of Atlanta scenes, when they filmed that on the studio set, the fire departments across Los Angeles kept getting calls because they thought that Hollywood was on fire. What it took to create that scene, just completely amazing. And then, of course, there's the kiss on the road to Terra. That's an indelible image as well. But there are some images here that are timeless.
I want to go to that one image that you were talking about. I mean, first you have all the casualties that are in the, looks like a hospital gymnasium or whatever it is.
It's a church.
And then she's freaking out because they're going to amputate that leg without any type of pain medication or anything like that, because they don't have anything. And so she leaves. She goes back and she tries to take care of Melanie and to deliver the baby and stuff. But when she comes back, it's not in that church any longer, right? It's in,
right.
It's out in the open. And not only is it out in the open, it's out in the open. We're seeing hundreds upon hundreds of people, if not thousands, wounded and dead. And it kind of brings home how this war really was. And don't want to say this is where I enjoy the movie, because I don't enjoy seeing people dying and things of that nature. But this is where the cinematography and the way they present things make this movie work for me. The fact that this is like one of those epic colored movies, because before this, we had a lot of black and white. In 1939, you know, we get this and we get The Wizard of Oz, and that's half of The Wizard of Oz that's in color, or maybe 3/4 of it. This is a grand scale movie. This movie is something different than has ever been seen before. I mean, if I were to compare it to like an epic movie, I think of, for whatever reason, I think of the Ten Commandments.
Visually
stunning this is.
Well, no, not a Lawrence of Arabia. We're talking about the 1930s movies. We're talking about Cecil B. DeMille.
Okay, sorry.
Well, that was the 50s, wasn't it? Cecil B. DeMille.
Sorry.
That was in the 50s, yeah. But you also had original Ten Commandments made earlier. But what that's I'm saying, true. As far as the scale of how a game changer, as far as how movies looked, Gone with the Wind is a game changer. We went over all the awards that it won, and not all of it was on acting. A lot of it was for technical reasons. This movie is a game changer when it comes to how a movie is made.
And they used all of Warner's, all 7 Technicolor cameras to film the movie as well.
Because it took three times more film.
It was an amazing amount of film.
Wait, think about it. This movie's only, 3 hours and 40-something minutes long? You wouldn't think it would take a lot of film to make this
movie. Oh, yeah.
There's a lot. As far as the scenes in the hospital, I know that they have to bring up the fact that Dr. Mead didn't have any chloroform, but to be perfectly honest, they weren't amputating legs with chloroform, even in the North.
This is brandy and booze if you could get it, huh?
You were lucky. It was basically...
Here's a piece of wood, bite down on it.
Exactly, yeah. or here's a mini ball.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I did during watching this movie. It helped. You know, I do feel bad, though, for Scarlett when she does eventually get home and her dad is messed up, her mom is dead. You know, we get to see that again later on with Rhett and their daughter. Almost looks like it's going to play out the same way, right? But you feel for her, and you feel that she has become a stronger woman due to everything that has been going on. And this is where I'm like thinking the tide is turning. She's going to be the woman that she is going to be.
I listened to everything that you guys talked about back and forth about Scarlett. I think that there are redeeming qualities about Scarlett. I think that, yes, that there are very irredeemable qualities about Scarlett. But I think a lot of what she does is done out of necessity. Because especially this period that we're going to be talking about leading into the second half, she does have to take control of the house. Because nobody else has control. She has to.
And when we were watching this with Annalise the other night, and there's one facial expression when she looks at her father And I think Annalise asked us a clarifying question. I said, and it's at that moment she realizes she's in charge of everything.
They raise the taxes on, and she has to come up with the $300. It's not that she wanted to marry her sister's betrothed. She has to, because he's going to take her away, and they're going to be left with nothing. And the carpetbaggers are going to come and take Tara. So, I mean, a lot of what she has, she does, is done out of necessity.
Whose necessity, though? Hers.
Well, it's they won't have anywhere to live. Her dad would be thrown into an asylum. Let's be perfectly honest. That they're just going to go hungry.
Well, her dad has already died before she takes that marriage proposal. He's already gone by that particular time. He dies when the assessor comes over.
Slattery.
The old overseer.
The overseer. Slattery. Right? Mm-hmm.
And he loses his mind and gets on his horse and tries to jump the fence, I guess. I mean, there she has an opportunity just to let it go. But again, it's the pride thing. The pride, you know, and maybe it has a little to do with honoring her family and honoring her dad by trying to keep the land. Yeah. By keeping it together. And I understand that. But she's stepping over so many people during it, especially her own family, who don't even appreciate it. She's not doing it for her sister, because her sister could marry this guy and she'd be fine. So really, in the sense, she's doing it just for her. Just for her.
No, she's doing it to survive. And you have to keep in perspective, when this starts, she's 16 years old. And this is only a period of 13 years that we're traveling with her along her life. So in today's standards, it would be considered a little bit different. But when she starts, she's still technically a child. At the barbecue at 12 Oaks, she's 16. You know, so we need to keep that in perspective, too. And I'll disagree with you till the grave that she's just not all in it for herself. So that leads us on to part two. With the defeat of the Confederacy, the O'Hara's toil in the cotton fields, Ashley returns, but find he is of little help to Tara. When Scarlett begs him to run away with her, he confesses his desire for her and kisses her passionately, but says he cannot leave Melanie. Scarlett's father attempts to chase away a carpetbagger from his land, but is thrown from his horse and killed. Unable to pay the reconstructionist taxes imposed on Tara, Scarlett unsuccessfully appeals to Rhett and then dupes her younger sister Sue Ellen's fiancé, the middle-aged and wealthy general store owner Frank Kennedy, into marrying her. Frank, Ashley, Rhett, and several other accomplices make right raid on a shanty town after Scarlett is attacked while driving through it alone, resulting in Frank's death. Shortly after Frank's funeral, Rhett proposes to Scarlett and she accepts. Rhett and Scarlett have a daughter whom Rhett nicknames Bonnie Blue, but Scarlett still pines for Ashley and, chagrined at the privileged ruin of her future, refuses to have any more children or share a bed with Rhett. One day at Frank's mill, Ashley's sister, India, sees Scarlett and Ashley embracing. Harboring an intense dislike for Scarlett, India eagerly spreads rumors. Later that evening, Rhett, having heard the rumors, forces Scarlett to attend a birthday party for Ashley. Melanie, however, stands by Scarlett. After returning home, Scarlett finds Rhett downstairs drunk, and they argue about Ashley. Rhett kisses Scarlett against her will, stating his intent to have sex with her that night, and carries the struggling Scarlett to the bedroom. The next day, Rhett apologizes for his behavior and offers Scarlett a divorce, which she rejects, saying it would be a disgrace. When Rhett returns from an extended trip to London, England, Scarlett informs him that she is pregnant, but an argument ensues, resulting in her falling down a flight of stairs, suffering a miscarriage. While recovering, tragedy strikes again when Bonnie dies while attempting to jump a fence with her pony. Scarlett and Rhett visit Melanie, who has suffered complications with a new pregnancy, on her deathbed. As Scarlett consoles Ashley, Rhett prepares to leave Atlanta. Having realized that it was Rhett, not Ashley, that she truly loved all along, Scarlett pleads to Rhett to stay, but he rebuffs her and walks away in morning fog. A distraught Scarlett resolves to return home to Tara, vowing one day to win Rhett back.
The tide definitely changes for Miss Scarlett on this one. A little bit more tragedy in her life. One tragedy after another.
The fact that it touches on marital rape is pretty interesting.
Explain this one to me, Batman. The next day, she seems quite happy.
That's one of the controversial parts of the movie.
She wasn't raped, though.
But I'm saying she's very happy.
She liked
it. Very satisfied. She's the happiest I've seen her in quite some time.
So let's read into this. Let's read into this. Let's go there, shall we?
He has a big thing.
Hey now.
Consensual, non-consensual. She likes it. She wants to be dominated. You guys, she's in charge. She's been in charge of everybody's lives. She has single-handedly carried her family into survival, and she's been in survival mode. She wants somebody to dominate her and make love to her and make her feel like a helpless creature. It's probably a fantasy, something she's wanted, and she's always in charge, so she wants to be dominated. That's where my woman brain goes. That's where
you.
I go.
I'm with you 100%
okay?
on that one.
So she liked it. She's like, okay, yeah, come get me. You're drunk. Get away from me. And he's like, I can crush you. And she knows. She knows he could hurt her. Maybe it's a little game. It's a manipulative game. My thought is he takes her exactly. It's not necessarily against her will. She likes it.
No. I agree 100%.
I do think it makes probably the audience a little bit uncomfortable, of course, especially when he's kind of like sitting there with his hands around her head. I'm there going, yeah, break it, break it. Anyway, you know he's not going to do it, but at the same time, you feel like, oh, kind of rough. And you know, then
I mean, even when he's drunk, he's still a gentleman in his talk. Have you noticed that? Even in his drunken demeanor, he's still gentleman-like. And
he's still Rhett. He's still
Rhett. He's Rhett Butler.
It's a little uncomfortable, but
not really. No.
I think it is.
What did you think, Michelle? Was it uncomfortable from a woman's point of view, that whole scene?
When I was younger, I didn't understand it. And now having a different perspective as an older woman, or middle-aged, being older, I should say, and not a young kid or a teenager, I have a completely different perspective on it. And it doesn't make me uncomfortable at all. I think it plays into that whole dark aspect of her character that people want to act all pious, that they don't want to relate to, but is that side of us too. She's taking care of everything. She wants to be dominated. She wants to be satisfied. She has held up her whole family. She's made it possible so everybody's living. So much tragedy has happened to her. You know, okay, come take me over. Show me all this passion. That's what she has inside of her, passion, lust, what she wants. I don't see it as uncomfortable at all.
Well, here's the thing. If you didn't see the next scene with her smiling in the bedroom, would you still feel comfortable with that? See, that's the thing, is we don't see her smiling until after all this has taken place. My perspective is this is your first time watching it, and you don't know the next scene is going to be her looking like she had the best sex that she's ever had in her life. It's got to feel a little uncomfortable. If you're not uncomfortable without knowing what the next scene is, then I'm a little worried about people and how they feel their characters.
But we know what the next scene is.
But we do. But I'm saying, as far as when we're first watching it, we should feel uncomfortable until we see the next scene.
Okay, we should. There's that morality in you. I love it. We should. Yes. We shouldn't relate to her. She's bad. She's selfish. She's manipulative.
You wanted him to crush her skull.
True that.
I feel, from my point of view, that this movie has stood the test of time because, again, it touches on those aspects of humanity that are darker, that we don't want to see, that we don't want to dive into and look at. Anything we can do to survive, to feeding that manipulative part of our psyche and doing what we want and going back to those spoiled brat ways of childhood. And I want my way, and I'm a 16-year-old and I want everybody's attention and it should all be about me. And that kind of plays into that as well.
Her midlife crisis at 28 years old.
The timing of it. And again, hence too, and again, from a woman's point of view, tell Captain Butler that I don't intend to have any other children. You know, if she's trying to sort out her feelings with, lacing up the corset, you've had a baby, you're never going to be the size again. And again, going to that vain side. Yeah, it deals with a lot of that darkness. Think of the time when this was released, 1939 too. And everything going through everybody's minds when watching that scene. And like you said, Ken, well, what if you didn't see that next scene where she was smiling? What would you think? I don't know. What would you think? Your imagination would run away with you. And that's the beauty of it.
Here's the thing. I'm looking at a 13-year gap is what you're saying. 16 to 29, is that what we're looking at here roughly?
Yes, I believe it's the 13 years. The movie spans 13 years, and I believe she's 16 when the movie starts.
So here's my biggest problem with this movie is her obsession with a guy that she doesn't love for 13 years and finds out here in the last 5 minutes of the film that she doesn't love him.
Time out on the field. Have you ever learned something the hard way, Ken?
Not over 13 years. I don't think I have.
Oh, okay. Well, good for you.
At least I don't have an infatuation with one person who's not my wife for 13 years and been desiring for that person and just waiting for an opportunity to get out. She just hasn't moved on. Just the fact that it is Ashley, and there's nothing that has given us any idea of why she loves him or why she's infatuated with him, only because...
Because she wants what she can't have. And
oh, yeah.
Isn't
yeah.
there a side of us right. that it all has that? And I think for you, and I'm not trying to make this male, female, or misogynistic, mm-hmm. or doing any stereotypes here, but if we come at it from a very logical, strategical point of view, it's not making sense to you. You're saying, get over it already. This is not logical to me. Why do we have this obsession? Why do we keep going back to this when we know it's not working?
Why is it resolved in 5 minutes when somebody dies? That's my biggest problem, is it's resolved in less than 5 minutes. As soon as somebody dies, she's figured it all out. She realizes that she's not in love with him because she's in love. And then she blames him for stringing her along all these years.
Part of that could be cinematic interpretation of the novel. And again, this is where I'm going to mark myself down.
We don't care about the novel. We just care about the movie because that's what we're reviewing.
Okay, I got it.
Time out. So here's the thing. At the
end
of the movie,
when did this turn into a football game all of a sudden?
I got penalized 15 yards for roughing.
I actually really like how the movie wraps up. Because we get this dramatic realization and the light bulb finally goes on in her brain that Ashley is a milquetoast nobody and wouldn't be anything without her, because basically she gave him all the money after the Civil War. She realizes that he'll never satisfy her because he's just a limp character. And so she realizes this and goes back after the person that actually has a backbone and is a badass. He goes, what? You know what? You've messed up your chance. The bottom line to the whole thing is it remains nebulous. I mean, he does tell her, frankly, Scarlett, I don't give a damn. And he walks off into the fog. Do we really think that he's never going to come back to her? I don't know, because she is his Achilles heel. He always comes back to her every single time. So I think that there probably would have been a reconciliation. I do want to give Victor Fleming and the screenwriter credit here before we really wrap this up. Thankfully, they didn't redo Birth of a Nation, and they left the Klan out of the whole quote-unquote political meeting that they were going to. I didn't need that in Gone with the Wind. If you know, you know. You know what they're doing. They're dressing up in hoods, and they're going out, and they're going to get the people in that shanty town. That's what they're doing.
I didn't realize that that's what they were doing.
Thankfully, there was restraint that was taken by both the screenwriter and the director that said, we're not recreating a Birth of a Nation here. But there are strong implications during that whole sequence from when she is attempted to be raped all the way through where Frank dies and Rhett brings Ashley back wounded. There is some serious Klan idealism and everything that goes along with it that permeates that whole section of the movie. But thankfully, we didn't get to see it on screen. I particularly like how the movie ends.
I want to just add one more thing here about what we just talked about with Rhett and Scarlett. The fact that she gets caught with Ashley in that embrace, not only is Melanie embarrassed by this situation, but Rhett is very embarrassed by this.
He's worried about Bonnie's reputation.
Well, not just
and her being in society.
And I kind of wished that she would have got what she deserved at that party, except because nobody seems to teach her a lesson. Rhett tries to teach her a lesson here by making her face the music by herself, but then there's no music to face. You know, she gets off scot-free. Everybody lets her get off scot-free from all the things that she does. And I think at this particular time, Rhett goes back and forth. So
her pride is hurt, though.
I've been in this situation where I went back to a girlfriend multiple times, and the hurt was too bad at one particular point to ever really consider it again. Did it mean that I stopped loving that person? No, I always loved that person, but I realized that person was poison. You said earlier, the Achilles heel is always going to bring you down. It's going to do something to you. It's never going to be the love that you deserve or the love that you need. That's the other problem I have with Scarlett here is she's never going to be good for Rhett, because in a relationship, you have to think about each other. And I don't think she can ever think about him.
Well, they're two strong-willed people. That's the problem. They're both strong-willed, both a little selfish. You know,
he does everything to her. I mean, he does vinegar, everything for her. He rebuilds her whole estate. He helps with everything. I mean, she does a great job of getting it to a certain point, but then when she wants to bring it back to its glory days, it's Rhett that makes it happen. And it's Rhett that says, hey, let's sell your business. Let's move away from here and do a life of our own. And she's always the one that says, no, no, no. He cares about her.
Sounds like Amy Winehouse.
She's not going to go back to rehab. But he's always trying to make the relationship work. And she's only caring about
because
she wants
what she can't have. And as soon as Melanie dies and she realizes she could very easily move in on Ashley, then she doesn't want Ashley anymore. And then Rhett's like, peace out. I don't want anything to do with you.
The game is over, right?
And the game is over. And now she wants him. So it's this yearning for what we can't have. And again, I think her character embodies so much of that side of the human condition that we have to take into consideration that we have under wraps, and even more so in a 1939 audience. You know what I mean? And it still holds true today. What's better, the anticipation of something, planning the vacation, or actually going on it? Well, both of it. But the anticipation sometimes of something is better. And again, I think it plays back into that spoiled bratness of her character, wanting what she can't have, wanting it all. The bottom line is she survives. She strategizes. She does whatever she can, and she survives.
And she's never going to be happy.
Well, here's the thing.
She's never going to be happy.
I guess I have a little bit of a hopeless romantic that lives inside of me. The ending has changed, has adapted over the course of the years. I don't look at the end now that she wants what she can't have. I think she has a realization that she truly does love Rhett. That's how I want to see it. You guys, Ken and Michelle, argue it back and forth. That's my perspective of it.
I haven't started arguing yet. No, I'm just kidding.
I think she does love him.
I want to believe in the idea that there is true love there and that she realizes it finally. Like Eric said, the way the movie ends is kind of brilliant because she does realize that she does love him, and it makes it all the more heartbreaking that she now can't have him. Like I said, it leaves it up to interpretation of how you want to end it. I think it's a beautiful way to end the movie, in my opinion.
Oh, and I'm not saying that she doesn't realize that she doesn't love Rhett. I think she does too. I think it just, a lot of it plays on the human condition, because you're scratching your head throughout the movie. Like, why is she going after Ashley, 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 Ashley? You just don't get it. But I think it's that part of that just lusting after what, you know, the anticipation of something. But I'm not denying that she doesn't realize that all of a sudden at the end in 5 minutes. She does love Rhett. Yeah, I'm not denying that either.
Talk about 5 minutes. It's time to wrap it up.
And let's go into our reviews. I'm going to start off with Ken.
I'm going to go with the Guardian staff. They had said if the story had been cut short and tied up at the point marked by the interval, and if the personal drama had been made subservient to a cinematic treatment of the central theme, then Gone with the Wind might have been a really great film. The movie is too long. The movie, it could be half of what this movie was. Maybe a little over 2 hours would be acceptable. Let's say you took all the overture and the breakout and stuff. I think it still comes in at like 3 hours and 40 minutes, roughly. That's way too long for this type of situation. It's a very downer type of movie. It's not a very uplifting movie at all, which there's nothing wrong with that. Some of the greatest movies in history are ones that don't have a happy ending. Their daughter dying was really kind of like the nail in the coffin that I had, that just like another person's dead. it pushed down the tragedy note so much in this movie. It made me hard to enjoy the relationship between Rhett and Scarlett. I like the chemistry there, but it's just too much back and forth. I think that they should have cut out somebody dying or whatever the case may be. It's still a good movie. Like I had said earlier, the way it's shot kind of redefined the epic movie at that particular time. So there's really some really good things here. Is it a little dated? Yes. Does it paint a really interesting picture of how the South thought they were treated by the North? Yes. If you just take those all out, because now we get to look at it because we've been, you know, decades later, we could take a look at that and say, yeah, this is a problem. This is a problem. But as far as a movie and how a movie is made from start to finish, I think it just misses the mark for me just because a lot of the characters are just not likable. But at the same time, I still like the movie. Michelle is going to be surprised that I like the movie, but it's not on a high scale. I'm going to give this movie 3 hooks out of 5. It's not a movie I probably would see again, but I do appreciate coming back to it and reminding me of why people think it's good and why people, you know, maybe don't think it's as great as people think it is. I just think it's just a tad overrated. I don't think it should have won the Oscar for Best Picture of the Year that year, but it's still a movie that everybody should see.
My critic is going to be Kath Clark with Time Out. She puts, "No one watches Gone with the Wind for historical accuracy. What keeps us coming back is 4 hours of epic romance and gorgeous technicolor." I like the movie. I think the movie was too long. There's a lot of stuff that could have been cut out, but I love the characters. It's a good movie. It really grew on me as I watched this. I think the second part of the movie is much more interesting than the first part of the movie. Some people might debate that, but I'm going to keep it simple. For me, this one is 3.5 hooks. It's a good movie. I really like to see the unedited version of it down the road. I know we didn't get into that. Some words were changed, a few other things here and there. Just the way I like to watch movies. So let's go with Ted. Ted, what are your thoughts?
My critic is Roger Ebert, and this is part of his review. Shocking. From his great movies book. He writes, "Gone with the Wind presents a sentimental view of the Civil War in which the Old South takes the place of Camelot, and the war was fought not so much to defeat the Confederacy and free the slaves as to give Miss Scarlett O'Hara her comeuppance. But we've known that for years. The tainted nostalgia comes with the territory. Yet Gone with the Wind is still a towering landmark of a film, quite simply because it tells a good story and tells it wonderfully well." That sums up a lot of my views here. Like I said before, this is not a documentary. This is not Ken Burns doing the Civil War. Let's be perfectly honest. This is a love story. This is a novelization. And this is one person's perspective. When I was in college and I was studying to be a teacher of history, one of the things that they wanted us to teach was to put yourself in the perspective of somebody in that time frame. And this is what this is. This is a landmark movie. This is a towering achievement. The Academy actually had to add an award, a special award for how the movie was made, is something that is amazing. And Michelle and Ken have talked so much about nostalgia and growing up. I can't separate that from this movie for myself. This isn't the reason I love the Civil War, but it was an introduction. And if you talk to any major Civil War historian, this is a major part of what got them into the Civil War. This movie is amazing for me. I've seen it on the big screen. I love it. And it hurts my heart that I may never see it on the big screen again because people can't get over themselves. This is a 5-hook movie for me. It's straight up.
Way to keep your marriage, Ted. Way to keep your marriage.
So I know that's how it's going to come off to seem, but you know what? I'm going to tell you perfectly honest and inside baseball. My mom loved this movie. This was a reason that I knew that Michelle and I were destined to be together because she absolutely adores this movie too.
Okay, Michelle, you are rounding us out because it's your movie. It's your time. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, before I give you my review, I would like to say thank you.
Thank the Academy.
I would like to thank you for letting me guest star on the podcast. I'm all about perspective taking. I appreciate you watching a movie that I know wasn't many of your favorites, being willing to review something maybe a little bit out of left field. I appreciate it. And I hope that you have more guests and they suggest their favorite movies in the future. I think that would be neat to hear other people's perspectives and you all take like an open mic, like an open vote, like suggest a movie and then have a guest on. So
hey, thank you so much. As long as we don't have to watch Clerks 2, I'm happy.
So thank you so much for having me on. And
next week, Eric, we're doing Clerks 2.
And I also wanted to say that even if Ted hated it, it would be fine. Because again, I really enjoy hearing other people's perspectives on things. And in your podcast too, I've really listened to your views on different movies and how you come at them either from, you know, a specific perspective from a director, an actor or background on the movies. It's been very interesting to me. So thank you for educating and teaching me. So with that being said, my reviewer is going to be Kevin Thomas of the Los Angeles Times. And he says, Gone with the Wind endures and deepens with the passing of time because Rhett and Scarlett are as modern as its open ending. And I think that sums it up perfectly because the back and forth of their characters and, you know, when she realizes she does love him at the end and the darkness in both of them that they show us and just whatever Scarlett needs to do to survive. Just like when I opened with, after all, tomorrow is another day. I think that just, again, speaks to her perseverance in the face of whatever was thrown at her at the time. And again, from the perspective of a life of privilege and what she enjoyed and what her whole life about was just demolished by this conflict, this war happening. She doesn't deny her from loving fiercely, though, from persevering. And even her mantra of, oh, fiddle-dee-dee. In other words, I'm not going to think about that right now. I'm going to focus on what's important. I'm going to learn life's lessons and I'm going to strategize and move forward. And I think I can connect in some way with several of the characters in this movie and especially Scarlett's characters. So definitely 5 hooks for me. And that's not to even mention the cinematic masterpiece that I think it is as far as the different things for its time, you know, for 1939, what it brought as far as the technicolor of the movie, the length of the movie, the storyline, and the screenwriters from taking, I know we're not interested in the novel, but taking a novel and turning it into an epic story based around a war in the Reconstruction period afterwards. So 5 hooks for me, a must-see.
All right, beautiful. Ted, where can they find us on the World Wide Web?
We can be found on Twitter or X at @hookon_movies. And of course, whatever podcast version you're listening to us on, whether it be Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, leave us a 5-star rating. It helps us get noticed and helps us get our name out there too.
All right. What's the next movie we're doing?
Okay. Well, it's baseball season, so we're going to do Bull Durham.
Bull Durham.
Another great love story.
Great minor league love story that is Bull Durham. Awesome. What's going on Facebook there?
Oh, just join us on our Facebook page, Hooked on Movies. We play trailers, scenes from movies, talk about movies, probably ban Michelle from ever doing a contest ever again on it. But, it, you know, it is what it is. So please join us on our Facebook page, Hooked on Movies.
What are your thoughts on Bull Durham, Michelle? Seen it?
Well, being married to Ted for over 20 years and being together for almost 25 years, I have watched every sports rom-com there is. I just don't care for the genre of it, the sports integrated with the love story. It's not my cup of tea. But again,
She prefers the racism with her love story.
Oh, my goodness. No, no. Time out on the field. No, don't. Say that, edit it out.
Okay, how long you been holding that one in, Ken?
But only 10 seconds.
Only 10 seconds. It came to him. All right.
She really loves Tin Cup. That's her favorite movie.
Because he tortured me with it. You don't understand how many times I've had to watch Tin Cup and
Stockholm
I don't
syndrome.
Care for it.
See, it's running rampant in your family. I see how it is now.
I feel bad because you didn't get to say a lot during the podcast. So you was like silent
me?
Eric.
No,
yes.
No, I, you know, it depends on the movie. There are movies where I'm extremely vocal, and there are movies where I was not. I knew you were going to come in, lead this. You were going to be our Scarlett O'Hara. You were going to take control. And I learned a lot about this movie. It was really interesting. It's all good. And I want to thank you for coming on the Hooked on Movies podcast. It's been a
pleasure.
Thank you
for having me. Thank
you. We've had a few people here and there, and we hope to have more down the road. So join us next week for Bull Durham. It's baseball season 2024, and what a way to kick it off with Bull Durham. This means something, and of course, I'm talking about the podcast.
See you at the movies.
See you next time on Hooked on Movies.
Thanks for having me on Hooked on Movies.